Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 15th of February, these are our main stories. Ukraine's new army chief goes to the front line and warns of extremely difficult conditions. Also,
all of a sudden, people started crushing forward. Everybody started running. There was screaming.
There's one fatality and multiple injuries during a shooting at a victory parade for the American football Super Bowl winners in Kansas City. And the discovery in apes of a very common human trait.
The teasing in great apes was provocative. It was very intentional. They are poking each other. They are hitting. They pull on their hair, body parts.
Also in this podcast, we've got food innovation news for you from South Korea.
They've taken rice, covered it in fish gelatin, stuck some beef cells onto that, and then they let it grow for a while in the lab in a dish.
That sounds appetizing, doesn't it? And why there could be a less painful side to the sting in a scorpion's tail. We start, though, in Ukraine, where the country's new commander-in-chief has acknowledged that the situation for his forces on parts of the front line in its war with Russia is extremely difficult. It appears to be a blunt and candid assessment almost 2 years in from General Oleksandr Sirsky. His comments came on the day that Ukraine's military announced it had targeted another Russian warship, the Caesar Kunikov, in the Black Sea. I asked our correspondent in Kyiv, James Waterhouse, if what the general was saying was what those close to President Zelensky and also in Moscow and the West have known for quite some time.
I think so. And I think it's also interesting, Robin, that his predecessor, General Zaluzhny, who was fired last week, lost his job primarily because of Ukraine's lack of progress on the front line. Now, Oleksandr Sirsky is visiting the city of Avdiivka in the east, a city that Ukraine has held on to for as long as it can. It's inflicted enormous Russian losses compared with its own, but still, they are still losses nevertheless. They also visited Kupiansk, where the Russians are edging ever closer from across the river from the east. And it is a difficult picture. You have Ukrainian troops that are frustrated with dwindling ammunition, and it is Russia mounting wave after wave of attack. There is a real-time impact where you have political disagreements in the West that is directly affecting what Oleksandr Sirsky was seeing alongside the defence minister today.
Are his comments, a message either from him but also from Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, very much aimed at Washington, at other allies who may be wavering in their support for Ukraine as well?
I think so. I think what's interesting about the head of the armed forces in General Sirsky is also looking to kind of give a clearer picture as possible to manage those expectations. But yes, I think there is a lot of weight in what he is saying, where he is trying to paint a picture which is undoubtedly bleak. You know, we've been to cities like Kupiansk, where you have people living under shelling, where they are angry and fearful of the approaching Russian army, but they don't want to leave their homes. And they certainly don't want to live under occupation, but it may well soon not be their choice. But as ever with the West, since the full-scale invasion, it's not strictly been a case of what the West has provided, but when. I think if you looked at the inventory, which has headed Kyiv's way, it's substantial. But the rate at which it has arrived in the face of Russia's war footing has caused Ukraine to get to where it is at this moment in time. It's still standing, but it is limping.
James Waterhouse speaking to me from Kyiv. Well, let's stay on this because it's been nearly 2 years now since Vladimir Putin launched his invasion of Ukraine, uprooting 10 million people from their homes. Our special correspondent Fergal Keane reported from the western city of Lviv on the massive refugee outflow. It was the biggest in Europe since the Second World War. Well, he's gone back to Lviv to report on those struggling with the impact of 2 years of conflict.
People are just crushing all around me, trying to get onto these trains. Young mother with a baby, they're screaming because everyone's getting crushed.
The memories are flooding back of all of those people, thousands. And nobody that we met had any idea what was ahead of them. It was just a question of getting out.
2 years on, the war has settled on Lviv station, a stubborn season that will not move. In the cold and shadows of Platform 5, young soldiers wait for trains that will take them east to the fighting. There is weariness. Then, as the train moves out, I see a short, stocky man with a wistful smile come walking down the carriage. He stops to chat. Volodymyr Moise is a military chaplain, but also a bringer of kindness. He and his wife foster troubled children, those displaced by the war, those from broken families. Like his 25-year-old foster son, Andriy, who went back to their village to try and protect his mother, an alcoholic.
She was still his mother, and he went and set up a small militia in the village in order to stop the Chechens. Unfortunately, they found out after some time. When they shot him, they just threw him dead out into the field.
Volodymyr meets up with his friend Alex at Kryvyi Rih station. They're heading together towards the front lines at Kherson, but with a mission to heal, not fight. They're bringing gifts to children living with the daily trauma of shelling. At a windswept bus stop in the countryside, a group of perhaps 20 mothers and children are gathered. The war can come crashing down here at any time, yet people cling to their homes. One of the mums, Larisa, coordinates the gift-giving sessions with Volodymyr.
They made a law that we must evacuate the children because our village is in the red zone. But when I asked them, "Are you going to be responsible for my children if I do it?" they said no. So I did not evacuate mine. I'm responsible for them. When Alex and Volodymyr come to see us, it's like a celebration for us and the kids.
Is it warm?
10-year-old Lera smiles as Volodymyr approaches and hands her a parcel. She'll wait until she's home to open it. Far off in the distance, there's muffled noise. Is it shelling or the wind? Lera asks such questions constantly.
We went with my mum and dad to Kryvyi Rih. They went to do works at our school, and there were 3 airstrikes. I was scared. The window was blown out in the room where my sister was.
The child cries and turns into her mother's embrace. But Volodymyr must leave now. There are many more journeys to make.
You know, I've stopped trying to understand this war long ago. It takes away life, and it even takes away the purpose of it. So it takes away the most important thing, time that a child can experience as a child.
Volodymyr Moise speaking through a translator there, ending that report by Fergal Keane. Now let's go to Kansas City in the United States, where at least one person has been killed in a shooting just after a parade by the city's Super Bowl-winning football team had finished. These people were in the crowd.
All of a sudden, people started crushing forward. Everybody started running. There was screaming. We didn't know what was happening, but this day and age, when people run, you run.
Well, Chief Stacey Graves is from the Kansas City Police Department. She spoke to reporters shortly before we recorded this podcast.
Officers responded to the area, took 2 people into custody, and also immediately rendered life-sustaining aid to those victims. We're still gathering information on the number and the status of victims. We know that one of the victims is deceased.
Well, it's thought there were hundreds of thousands of fans on the streets of Kansas City to attend the rally at the time that this happened. Our North America correspondent John Sudworth told me more about it.
Reports suggest that there was an estimated 1 million people in downtown Kansas City, Robin, for what was, of course, meant to be a day of celebration, celebrating, you know, a sporting triumph over the weekend with the Kansas Chiefs having won the Super Bowl. But it has clearly been marred by what is undoubtedly a very serious incident. You played a clip there from the press conference that we've heard, a confirmation of at least one person killed, a number of others injured. The police and the emergency services are still trying to get a handle on what happened and the full extent of those affected.
I thought it was so telling when we heard from the mayor speaking as well. One of the first things he imparted to people listening was that all members of the Kansas City Chiefs, that's the football team, were okay.
Absolutely. We understand that the celebrations with the team, who had been taken through Kansas City as part of a parade on buses and were later in the day at another celebration on a stage, that that was still ongoing as these shots were fired. The shots appear to have been in the vicinity of Union Station, a short distance away. I mean, the immediate thought, of course, given what was happening in the city, was that this was perhaps targeted at the parade itself or the team. And as you say, the reports so far suggest that the team are safe and well. But in terms of motive, that's obviously going to be something that's going to now be the focus of the police effort.
John Subworth in the United States. Well, let's stay there because one of the most senior legal figures in President Biden's administration has warned that artificial intelligence could be used to sow chaos and incite violence in elections. With the presidential contest coming later this year, the Deputy Attorney General, Lisa Monaco, has told the BBC that tougher sentences are also being planned for those convicted of using AI to commit crimes. Here's our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera.
Last month, some voters in America's New Hampshire primary received a phone call from what sounded like President Biden, telling them not to go to the polls.
Voting this Tuesday only enables the Republicans in their quest to elect Donald Trump again.
It was a so-called deep fake created with artificial intelligence. On a visit to London, the US Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco told me the fear was that this was only the first sign of what was to come with AI supercharging false information.
It can cause people to distrust the sources of information that they're getting, to dissuade them or confuse them in terms of exercising their right to vote, to incite violence, and to just generally sow distrust and potentially chaos.
Lisa Monaco describes AI as a double-edged sword because it's also being used by the FBI and prosecutors to help them investigate crimes. For instance, scouring through tips provided by the public or CCTV footage of events such as the riot at the US Capitol following the last presidential election. She also said that the use of AI in crimes such as fraud would be treated as an aggravating factor, much like the use of a gun in a robbery, and this would mean tougher sentences for those convicted.
Gordon Carrera reporting. Now let's change the pace a little bit because it seems we are not the only species to indulge in teasing our family and friends. The great apes do it too, according to new research by scientists who spent hours filming them at zoos in San Diego in California and also Leipzig in Germany. They documented more than 140 instances of apes winding up their neighbours. Isabel Laumer is a primatologist at Germany's Max Planck Institute of Animal Behaviour. And she told my colleague James Menendez more about what sort of behaviour researchers observed.
The teasing in great apes was provocative. It was a very intentional behaviour. They are poking each other, they are hitting, they pull on their hair, body parts. So we found it in all four great ape species, so in chimpanzees and bonobos, in orangutans and gorillas. And they teased in largely similar ways.
Do you know why they do it?
Through playful teasing, social boundaries can be tested and also the relationships can be strengthened. This we know from humans.
And the apes that were being teased, I mean, how did they react?
They typically reacted by ignoring as a first reaction, then eventually by showing mildly aversive behaviors and then even go away. Similar to human infants, the great ape teasers, they look into the target's face after showing a teasing action. So they are interested in the reaction of the target and probably also adapt their teasing behavior accordingly.
As someone who gets regularly teased by his own teenage children, do they tease their own parents?
That was also quite interesting. So just the gorilla was mostly teasing his mother, but the other infants we observed, they were actually teasing other adults from the group usually.
That sounds like bliss.
So for example, the chimpanzees we observed, the juvenile was mostly teasing adult males, actually. Mm. We don't know if this is a species-typical thing. Therefore, we have to look at more groups of chimpanzees, for example, to say if they mostly tease adult males in this case.
I'm quite surprised, Isabel, that no one's, you know, done a formal study into this before.
It's not that no one ever observed this behavior. So this isn't a rare behavior, I would say, because if you go to a zoo, you're probably very likely to see examples of playful teasing. But it's not something that people have studied before, because people have usually looked at aggressive forms of teasing. So there are a few studies published on the more aggressive, like bullying forms of teasing, or people studied play. But for this study, we were the first ones to systematically analyze playful teasing. I mean, it had definitely provocative and also aggressive elements, but also playful elements. It's a very ambiguous behavior and therefore also very interesting to study.
I love this story. Even the great apes are winding each other up. Isabel Lammer there, speaking to James Menendez. Right, still to come on the Global News Podcast. This ain't Texas. Oh. Ain't no hold'em. Hey. So lay our cards down, 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 down. Why this song? It's a toe-tapper, isn't it, by Beyoncé, has stirred up the debate about what is and what is not country music. Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Let's go to the war in Gaza now and fresh evidence that it is a military confrontation being fought on several fronts. Israel launched what it called an extensive wave of attacks on Lebanon to its north on Wednesday. It came after an Israeli woman was killed in a rocket strike from across the border. Lebanon, remember, is a stronghold of the militant group Hezbollah. There have been regular exchanges of fire between the two sides since the war with Hamas began last October. Well, our correspondent Nick Beek, who's in Jerusalem, told me more about the significance of what has become an almost daily occurrence.
Notable today as in people were killed, four people on the Lebanese side, a woman and two children in one particular place, and Hezbollah say one of their fighters was also killed. Early this morning, Hezbollah launched rockets towards the north of Israel. A woman was killed in that. She was a soldier. And what Hezbollah is saying is that they're going to continue to launch rockets into northern Israel until there is a ceasefire in Gaza, until, as they put it, the aggression stops.
Nick, let's move on to some comments from Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has said that he is determined to press ahead with that military operation going into Rafah, right in the south of Gaza. Is it clear at all how far advanced we are in terms of that military operation happening and any plan to let civilians move elsewhere?
No, not at all. I mean, the only thing we have is Prime Minister Netanyahu tonight doubling down on this stated aim that he's been talking about for about a week now. And he told the Israeli people, we will fight until complete victory. Now, the thing is, he hasn't defined complete victory. He said, though, it includes a powerful action, as he put it, in the city of Rafah, now home to 1.5 million Palestinians, after we allow the civilian population to leave the battle zone. So, I mean, in short, Robin, it doesn't look like the dire warnings from Israel's allies, the United States, as well as the United Nations, aid agencies, has had any sort of effect on the thinking that Benjamin Netanyahu is contemplating at the moment.
Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, now raising very serious concerns about the prospect of this last part of the military operation.
That's reported tonight by the AFP news agency, and it follows other allies, including the United States, but also the United Kingdom, which I think is slightly different from America, because you've got Lord Cameron, who used to be the Prime Minister, of course, now the Foreign Minister, saying that there needs to be an immediate pause in the fighting, suggesting that has to be done extremely quickly if there is to be any sort of lasting peace in the Middle East, but also for the sake of the Gazans suffering so much at the moment.
Nick Beek speaking to me from Jerusalem. Well, as you heard there, Rafah in the south of Gaza is now home to about 1.5 million Gazans, more than 1 million of them displaced from other parts of the Gaza Strip. Most are living in horrific conditions with no sanitation. They're hungry and thirsty with little in the way of medical assistance. Martin Griffiths is the most senior person at the United Nations who's involved in the humanitarian response. My colleague Johnny Diamond asked him how the situation in Rafah would be affected by a ground assault from the Israeli forces.
It will be impossible. Breakdown of law and order, lack of proper access, bringing aid in, lack of anywhere safe to go. Huge numbers of people, over 1 million, compressed into this Rafah area, which normally holds about 250,000. In my experience, about the most difficult conditions for humanitarian operation that I've ever come across, and I've been around for quite a long time.
How long can you carry on?
I don't think we're carrying on at the moment. We're barely breathing in southern Gaza, and that is represented by the WFP report that we're down to 24 hours of food left, which is very, very unusual in a conflict. We've had our own drivers attacked and battered and desperate people taking food from wherever they can. So if we don't get safety guarantees, which I think is very difficult to rely on Rafah, there will be no humanitarian operation to rely on.
Can I pick you up on that point you make about 24 hours of food reserves? If you cannot move aid in today, in 24 hours, there will be no more food.
That's the logic of it. What happens is that, you know, one truck gets through during the day, or maybe two, and so that you sort of lurch from zero to one, thank God, for the next day. So it's always a bit difficult to predict zero for tomorrow, but that's what they're saying, that there is only that much left inside the country. We had hoped the food flour that is in Ashdod port, paid for by the United States, could have been taken in to Gaza. But I heard this morning that I think that arrangement is also now in question.
You have said that history will not be kind, referring to any ground invasion of Rafah. You don't believe that in this case history will be written by the victors.
It's not going to be kind of what's happened so far. It will be even less kind. Now, I understand why the Israelis want to move in on Rafah to recover those hostages, those poor people. But there is a choice. And what I want to say to you before it starts is, if there is an assault, you should not rely on the fantasy of a humanitarian operation being able to save people in the middle of such carnage. The safety and security of Israel has to depend in the future not only on resolving this particular crisis with Hamas, but on creating a generation of Palestinians who will live happily and well with their neighbors. So the security of Israel is at stake here, and it usually happens that the UN is blamed for the faults of others. I'm not taking that anymore. I am not prepared to accept criticisms of our efforts. We are trying our best. We are not the ones holding hostages. We are not the ones preparing for that assault.
That was Martin Griffiths from the United Nations, and since we spoke to him, his spokesperson has told us that several trucks of food were expected to get through to Rafah on Wednesday. Right, we're going to talk rice now. Rice with beef grown in it. Could this lab-grown innovation, which you can see pictures of at BBC News Online right now, be the answer to reducing the environmental impact of sprawling cattle farms? And also maybe a much-needed breakthrough in getting simple-to-deliver food to victims of famine. Well, scientists in South Korea say their hybrid creation is affordable, if not yet appealing to the eye. I found out more from our digital health editor, Michelle Roberts.
It's slightly pink. Imagine the look of raw beef. It's a little bit more brittle than normal rice, so maybe al dente. So they are looking at it as a food source that they're saying could answer some of the things in the world that we know are an issue. For example, famine. If you can make rice more nutritious, what they've done is they've taken rice, they've covered it in this fish gelatin, stuck some cells onto that, so the muscle and the fat from beef, and then they let it grow for a while in the lab in a dish. And what you get is this sort of meaty rice, almost like a micro beef sushi.
So it sounds like the benefit is for delivering carbohydrate and protein to those who are most needy of it in a most efficient way.
They say it would be cheap. And they also say if you're looking at the eco credits of it, it's a lower carbon footprint than trying to farm meat. I mean, obviously, you still need the rice that you're growing, that's going to require water, land space, etc. But you're not having to farm cattle, which is where the ecological impact comes. Obviously, critics say that it changes the way that traditional things are done. And is that a good thing? There's also the kind of yuck factor that people need to think about too, because obviously consumers need to buy it if there is a market out there.
There are issues, aren't there? And we've learnt this over the last decade about persuading other consumers, those who do have a choice, to buy and consume this kind of lab-grown product.
There was a London restaurant that famously gave somebody a burger that had been lab-grown. Some other countries have looked at actually selling some of these types of products. So Singapore's had some chicken that's made in the lab, if you like. This is real chicken cells that they've just grown up.
Michelle Roberts. Now, the scorpion is famous for that nasty sting in its tail, but it turns out it's also a crucial part of its mating process. A new study has found that during a somewhat elaborate ritual, the female allows and even encourages the male to sting her. Stephanie Prentice explains why.
When it comes to mating, scorpions aren't known for keeping it simple. The first stage involves what scientists call a courtship dance, as the male grabs the female's pincers and moves her around. The next stage is critical. If the female doesn't run away, attack him or eat him, he will then sting her between 1 and 3 times before the act of insemination. What's been a matter of debate is why the famously aggressive arachnids allow themselves to be stung. Now, a new study from the National University of Cordoba in Argentina suggests they may be using the stings to assess their partner. The team hypothesised this is because female scorpions only mate a few times in their life and are highly selective about who they mate with. To better understand the selection process, they collected 200 scorpions and studied them in a purpose-built mating arena. And while 53% of females agreed to the courtship dance, only a third went on to the insemination. Those that stayed in the courtship lay very still as the male stung them in their soft body region. The team concluded that the female may be analysing the quality of the sting, the venom, and even endurance levels. It concluded that while scorpions have a bad reputation, in their words, there are a lot of behaviours that are fascinating.
Stephanie Prentice reporting. Now, as promised a few moments ago, time for a bit of country music.
This ain't Texas, ain't no hold'em, so lay your cards down, 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 down.
Are you toe-tapping? I am. Well, what you've just heard is a bit of Beyoncé's new song, Texas Hold'em. The singer announced her new album at the Super Bowl on Sunday. As you might be able to guess from that clip, it's a country album. Fans have been requesting that song at various radio stations in the days since. But one country station in Oklahoma refused to play it, saying Beyoncé is not country. This has reignited a discussion online about what is country and who is considered a country artist. My colleague James Reynolds has been speaking to Kyle Trigger Coronius. He is a country music writer, and he asked him what he thinks of the song.
There is most certainly country music elements in there. There's a banjo and there's a fiddle, essential country music elements, and they're played by an artist named Rhiannon Giddens, who is native to country music. But at the same time, there's also elements that don't feel very similar to country music. There's not really a story. Storytelling is pretty important to country music, and it's more of a rhythmic-based track as opposed to a melodic track.
Isn't that the point, though, of artists? They can take a genre, take some things of a genre, and then say, I'm going to add a little bit of my new twist.
Most definitely. And country music, like all genres, needs to evolve. But unlike other genres, country has a unique history of wanting to sort of hold on to its roots. And country music is very much like a nostalgic-based thing. They were actually harkening back to music of old time. So it's always fighting tooth and nail, you know, people wanting to evolve the genre and other people wanting to withhold to those sort of pure roots of the genre.
I wonder if Beyoncé fans might say, well, she's also native to country music. She is from Texas, and it's music she's coming back to after a long time in other genres.
Sure. And I, being born and raised in Texas, as I was too, it doesn't give you necessarily a birthright to play country music, but it is certainly an element. And that's why I think we have to be careful to not just discount these songs outright or anything, because I'm sure that growing up in Houston, she interfaced with country music. And so she wants to express that part of herself. And I think that she'd be allowed to. I think it's also okay, and fans should be allowed to say, well, we don't think this is country music. There's certainly country elements there, but we don't know if this is country music or not. And that's the debate that's ongoing.
And is there a real line between country music and music with country elements in it?
I guess that's the big question, because, you know, like you had Lil Nas X a few years ago, and he had a banjo in his Old Town Road song. But ultimately, Billboard decided there weren't enough country elements in there to deem it a country song. So really what these chart managers and DJs and eventually the award shows are going to have to reckon with is it more country than it is anything else? So is there more R&B? Is there more pop? Is there more hip-hop elements to it than country elements?
Kyle, do you have to be brought up in the southern states of the United States, have a certain background to be a country star?
I think that that's a scary element of gatekeeping that shouldn't be allowed. There are country artists that come from the UK, from Europe, from South Africa. I think anyone who has a true desire to make country music in their heart should be allowed to do that. And I think you have to recognize that over history, there has been an element that also includes race in that profiling of what country music is. And that's not fair to black and brown creators. Everybody should be allowed to make country music, but that music ultimately has to be country. Or if it's not, then the genre loses its borders and then it just becomes another part of the pop blob, so to speak.
Kyle Corionios speaking to my colleague James Reynolds. Finally, in this podcast, since the advent of online dating, there's been an explosion in the range of apps available, whether for casual dates, long-term relationships, even for vegetarians and vegans. But what about dating along political lines? Well, to mark St. Valentine's Day, here's Sean Wales.
Perhaps, despite appearances, I like you very much.
Apart from the smoking and the drinking and the vulgar mother and the verbal diarrhea.
No, I like you very much. Just as you are.
If the 2001 romantic comedy film Bridget Jones' Diary is anything to go by, Mark Darcy and Bridget's relationship would suggest that opposites attract. And while in some cases that may be true, it seems more and more people like to stick to what they know. Dating apps are now popping up, designed to help people meet a partner that shares similar political views.
There hasn't been an app until now based solely on political affiliation. If you're right of center politically and you're looking to date other people like that, we have a place for you.
In the US, the dating app The Right Stuff gives new meaning to the phrase swiping left or right. John McEntee is the app's co-founder. The app has 60,000 users. Somewhat ironically, most of them are in majority Democratic areas like California.
It's been out for a year. We've had 10 couples getting married from the app. I actually went to the first wedding. It was a lot of fun to see.
A 2020 YouGov Economist poll found 86% of Americans think it's become harder to date someone who supports the opposite political party. It's not just happening in the US. Last year, right-wing dating app was launched in France. And in Brazil, Alex Felipelli launched Lefty, a dating app for progressives. Perhaps seeing an opportunity ahead of the US election, lefties also launching in America.
I don't blame that someone wants to be with someone else that shares those core values. In Brazil, you had strengthened polarization during the election year 2 years ago. That brought this topic to the attention among dating users, let's say, people looking for dates, right?
An ever-expanding online dating market, helping people find that special someone. Someone like you. Or perhaps more accurately, someone like them.
Sean Wales reporting. Right, that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed brilliantly by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was fantastically Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. This is the last one from me, so thank you very, very much for listening. I've enjoyed all of them. I hope you have too. Goodbye.